Okay, good morning, all.
Good morning.
Is this for next week?
Good morning, all. So two thank yous before we begin. The first is obviously thank you to Stan and to Sherry Fish for putting together all this food, and it's really quite beautiful. Anyone else we need to thank?
Howie,
thank you so much for helping set up, and it's really beautiful. Thank you, as always. The other thank you, and this is more of a general thank you for all the breakfast. This is what the $5 is for, to keep the lights on. An additional thank you is to Carol Tabin, actually, because all of the for this year, we're very excited. All of the breakfasts in the bases that we're going to be doing, which we have six breakfasts in the base this year, God willing, planned. This is the first of them. And we decided to buy a biography of each of the figures that we're going to be speaking about. So Carol generously sponsored all of the books for breakfasts in the base. Her late husband, Harvey Tabin. There's a little inscription in all the books, so we thank Carol for sponsoring.
I called her to come this morning. I was supposed to. She called me
early. Well, please let her know that she was thanked, and there's a recording, and God willing, she'll come to the future ones. Okay, so we're going to get started now. And when you speak about Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch, was born in the 1800s, in the early 1800s, the exact date was on June 20th, 1808, or the 25th of Sivan, 5568. And the reason why Rav Hirsch is such an important figure for us to be learning about in particular is that many people call him and consider him the father of modern Orthodox Judaism. And quite frankly, that's almost an understatement for who he was and what he represented. In many ways, he is the father of Judaism in the modern day. In other words, not just modern Orthodox Judaism, but really all Judaism. And the reason why is because you can't even begin to learn about who Rav Hirsch was without understanding the historical context that he was born into. The 1800s was a very, very difficult time for Jewish people, not necessarily because of outside oppression, although of course there was anti-Semitic things that happened in the 1800s, that's no secret and no surprise to anyone. But of course the 1800s is very famous in Jewish history in that the Reform movement took off and started in the 1800s. And Rav Hirsch sort of found himself in the middle of this conflict, of this new group of Jews who were, quite frankly, responding to the times. And it wasn't just someone woke up and decided they wanted to change how we've lived our Jewish lives for thousands of years. There was a reason and a context for how this started. And that was that there was a new enlightened time, right? The modernization of the world that we have nowadays really started in this time. There was the Haskalah, right? There was a knowledge that was being spread, and people wanted to learn more and become more educated. And that spilled over into the Jewish communities as well. They didn't want to live their ghetto lives and their sheltered lives of not really knowing anything, of just learning, you know, some of these old ancient texts and not really being advanced and learning the philosophies of the world and the sciences of the world and the arts of the world. They wanted to be cultured too. And as a result, Judaism, or many Jews, felt the need to keep up with that. And so Reform Judaism got started on that note. Reform Judaism, as is with, unfortunately, a lot of these more modern movements, was not started off to be anti-Orthodoxy. There was no such thing as Orthodoxy, obviously, back then, but it was not started off to be really outside of the fold of the normal Jewish life. It was really, in some ways, Reform Judaism of the 1800s was started off to be like a modern Orthodoxy as we know it nowadays. It was supposed to be a Judaism that, in theory, was fully connected to all the traditions of the past, in most ways at least. With the caveats of being more cultured and being more involved in the world, which is obviously how I believe we would define modern Orthodoxy, at least in general terms, nowadays. So we do need to understand the Reform context that Rav Hirsch was born into. So take a look at source number one in your packets. So what we have over here is literally a cut and paste from the URJ, the Union for Reform Judaism's website, and they have a brief timeline. It's not entirely accurate, which is fascinating, but they do have a brief timeline, which we'll focus on a couple of things. So number one, if you look so you see where it says there's a box that says 1810 on the left side. There's a right 18 box and a right 1810 box and a left 1810 box. So look at the left one, and it says And it mentions probably one of the most important people for the Reform movement and really the founder of Reform Judaism in many ways, and that was Abraham Geiger. We'll learn a little bit more about him in the next few minutes, but Abraham Geiger was a very important person in that he really set the tone for what Reform Judaism would be, and it's even a little bit more complicated as these stories tend to go and as history tends to go, in that he actually had a chavrusa with Rav Hirsch when they were both in university together for a short while, and they did have that background together as being close friends, and of course that sort of took a bad turn at some point. So he's a really important figure to be aware of. Take a look at the right 1810 box. So it talks about the first Reformed temple that was opened. It was in Seesen, Germany. Now this was the real official Reformed temple to be opened. It was opened by a guy named Israel Jacobson. Now Israel Jacobson was a very, very wealthy man, and as very, very wealthy people who are mad at the man tend to do, he started this temple really not even with such a movement behind him, the more in that he believed that Judaism needed to move in this direction of being more modernized, so they put an organ in the shul, and they had a choir in the shul, but he was the one who funded it all. So he didn't really have a strong movement behind him. So this was the first real Reformed temple, but it didn't really take off until the next 10, 15, 20 years, and that's when Reformed Judaism really did take off. Just a few other interesting dates as you go to page 3. In 1875,
Excuse me. Is there significance of the word temple versus shul?
Oh, it's a fantastic question. So temple, as we know, is how we would probably define in English the Beis HaMikdash, right? Everyone knows the Beis HaMikdash was called the temple. So part and parcel of the Reform movement was all about, again, not maybe at this point, but eventually, was all about saying that we are happy and content with where we are right now. This ancient dream of going back to the land of Israel, to Jerusalem, that's never going to happen. Stop living in the past. Let's embrace the future. And part of embracing the future is saying that our temple, our Beis HaMikdash, is here, right wherever we're davening. So it's a bit of a destroying a concept that Chazal have, because we know Chazal tell us that our shuls are called mikdashes ma'at, right? Mini temples, as they were. But we know through our Jewish traditions and through our texts that we view our shuls as sort of a conduit and a dream to God willing get back to the ultimate temple that we will have one day in Yerushalayim. But the Reform notion was that no, these are our new Beis HaMikdashes. Which, by the way, that's why if you go and look at some of the Reform temples that they have in Germany in particular, they are beautiful. Absolutely gorgeous. And the reason why is because they're building a Beis HaMikdash, right? It was in Germany, but it was a Beis HaMikdash nonetheless. And if you're going to build a Beis HaMikdash, you should really go all out. So they were absolutely gorgeous. So that's why they were called temples. A fantastic question. Okay, so if you take a look at page 3, there's a book that says 1875. So Hebrew Union College was established. We'll just read the little blurb really quickly. The Union created Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. It just still exists today. A seminary to train rabbis for all American congregants. So just to give you a framework of when this happened historically. So Rav Hirsch lived until 1888. So this was towards the end of his life. So Rav Hirsch really was battling through the real beginnings and the foundations of Reform Judaism. And obviously he wasn't completely successful in eradicating them. Obviously, but they didn't have a real smicha program, as it were, until towards the end of his life. And at that point, the battle has sort of been lost, at least at that end of things. 1883 is the very famous Treif banquet that many of us are familiar with. Take a look at the bottom box on the left. Following the first HUC ordination of 4 rabbinic students, a celebratory dinner was held in Cincinnati, attended by both Jews and non-Jews. The meal included clams, crabs, and frog's legs, and some people actually very famously left a Reform Judaism after this. They said this was too far. No way are we breaking our kosher standards. And as a result, people decided to leave Reform Judaism. But this obviously was the first absolute major in-your-face break. That it's like imagine the Wayu Chag HaSmicha, which they're having one this year, God willing. So imagine them serving crab at the Wayu Chag HaSmicha. It's unfathomable. But so this is exactly what they did for the first time ever, and that's why it was such a huge break. And from there on, it obviously just sort of devolved and dissolved from there into leading to modern day. So that's part of the Reform history that we have to be aware of. Take a look at page number 4, source number 2. That's just a picture if you want to get a sense of how beautiful these synagogues were. So this was that first synagogue made in Seesen, Germany by Israel Jacobson. So that can be found looking over there. Let's speak a little bit more about Abraham Geiger. So Abraham Geiger was born in 1810 and he died in 1874. So he was alive throughout the entire lifetime of Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch was a little older and died a little bit later. But again, so he was the founder of Reform Judaism. Take a look at source number 3 on page number 4, where we'll read a little bit more about who he was and how Abraham Geiger came to be and developed the Judaism that he did. So he says as follows: although Napoleon granted Jews full civil rights in 1807. Although Napoleon granted Jews full civil rights in 1807, socially they were still held in contempt by cultured Europeans. Tremendous pressure was placed on them to give up their strange, particularistic ways and leap into the richness of science, music, art, literature, and philosophy. Many acquiesced, believing that the new 19th century nationalism would provide them with full identity. The old ways of superstitions, religious rules, and regulations were passed. The new age of science and reason of unlimited truth had arrived. That was the context they were living in. Abraham Geiger was born into this cultural milieu. Geiger received a traditional Jewish education, but he was also introduced to the world of German culture. He studied Greek and Oriental languages in Bonn, where he met Samson and Rafael Hirsch. The two of them became friends. Geiger became a rabbi, but he also participated in the scientific approach to Judaism. He was horrified by the mass exodus of bright intellectual Jews from Judaism. Right? It's really important to understand that Reform Judaism wasn't founded, again, because someone just wanted to change things up a little bit. It was, in some ways, almost like a Kirov movement, right? They wanted to make sure people weren't leaving the fold, so they made it a cooler, hipper version of Judaism. Obviously, it didn't pay off in the ways that they would have hoped, but that's how it really started. The cream of European Jewry was embracing secular nationalism, and Geiger viewed this as a tremendous loss. He and a group of reformers determined to stop the flood. The solution, as they saw it, was to make Judaism, page 5, to make Judaism modern and acceptable to intellectual Europeans. In doing so, they hoped to keep young modern Jews Jewish and rid Europe of anti-Semitism. They believed that people hated Jews because Jews acted strangely, differently. By making Judaism a religion of reason, science, and aesthetics, they would enable Jews to remain both modern and Jewish. Right? So again, Reform Judaism was all about making these Jews who wore rags and lived in the ghettos, make them look like proud individuals and make them look like sophisticated individuals who were knowledgeable and could have a regular conversation with anyone. They could speak in German with a regular citizen of the country they're living in. And so they don't look like these schlubs that just walk around. Which, by the way, we'll get to Rav Hirsch in just a moment, but that's how Rav Hirsch actually did carry himself. Very famously, he carried himself as a very proud man. He always looked very put together. And the reason why was because he was trying to show that you could be a fully from Jew, but also look put together. You don't have to throw away half the Masorah in order to sort of fit in. You can keep the Masorah and also still look like a proud individual. We'll keep reading a little bit more. They began with 4 ascetic innovations which they justified within the existing framework of halacha. Number 1, some of the prayers were said in the vernacular. The vast majority of the prayers were still in Hebrew. Interestingly enough, by the way, we know that the halacha is that you can really say just about any prayer in English, right? There's no prohibition in saying it in a modern language, but many rabbis in this time period actually came out against saying prayers in German or in the regularly spoken language because of the movement, right? So in other words, it's permitted to technically say it in any language, but since the reformer movement was so pro saying it in the native tongue so that they can, again, fit in more and be normal, as a result, the quote-unquote Orthodox rabbis became against that. So that was the first thing they did. Number 2, their prayers were either recited or sung. The sing-song davening system was abolished because it threatened modern decorum. Number 3, the use of the...
What does that mean, the sing-song?
You know, we sing in shul. What do you mean? You've been to shul. What do you sing? Kedusha. People sing in the shul.
What's the difference between... What is the difference between singing and sing song?
In other words, okay, so there's 2 ways you can do it. You can have like this, like a weird, people sort of, how we do it in our shuls nowadays, right? So everyone's like sort of quasi singing along.
It's mirrors.
Okay, what about it?
You sing songs.
Right.
Going back and forth.
Okay, so let's frame it like this. Either you can be sitting in a show, or you can be participating in this like makeshift whatever. Exactly, you had a choir. You're going to a show. It was a whole. Yeah, they had the hats. You were going to a presentation, to a production. That was sort of the shift. It was not this makeshift weird little shtiebel thing. It was a proper opera that you were going to. That's what was the. That was the major difference.
What does it mean the sing song was abolished because it threatened?
Because, again, you go into our shul on Shabbos morning, which we all do love it, I hope and I think so. But so everyone's participating. This guy's singing. Everyone's getting involved in the Reform temples. Everyone sat down. They shut up and they would listen to the show. They listened to the choir lead, and you would just sort of observe. Which, by the way, what that obviously does, among many other bad things, is that it means that you don't actually have to read or look at the words that you're saying. You can just enjoy and see what the guys are doing up there in the nice stage. Number three, the use of the organ was introduced to make the singing more decorous. And number four, the sermon became the most important part of the service, and it was delivered in German. Right. So obviously one of the most noticeable things about these differences is that in many ways, in particular the last one, right, this was a major chiddush to have a sermon in the language of the country. And again, so nowadays, obviously, I hope that you won't find a single shul in America, or at least 99% of the shuls in America, you'll hear a sermon in English. So that is, in some ways, an innovation of the Reform movement. They were the ones that started that. And so because of that, there was some desire not to be like that. But again, these people didn't have as many bad intentions as you would have thought at the beginning. They were just trying to make it more accessible for people. At some point, they sort of went off the deep end. But some of these things were not such terrible ideas. Yeah, Jenny.
I don't know whether this was but if you read 1-4, it's exactly like a church service.
That's exactly right. So they were trying to fit in, right? They wanted to be like everyone else. As a result, they brought in the organ, just like the churches. They brought in a choir. They made it like the same production that, I don't know, anyone see a movie or something,
yeah,
see what they do in churches.
It was the Enlightenment period.
Exactly.
That's what they fit into the culture.
Exactly.
And they, before you knew it, they became more German than they were Jewish.
Exactly.
Would the sermon had been delivered previously in Hebrew or in Yiddish?
Okay, so it's a good question. My understanding is that for the longest time there actually was no sermon, and then there developed a need or desire to have more Torah, so they did have a sermon, and the major break of the Reform movement was translating that into English. Translating that into German. Yeah. But I believe back then, it's a thing that rabbis don't like to tell people from our history, but there was not always a sermon during the service. But that is the accepted way of doing things nowadays. Moving forward, so we'll just read a couple more lines over here, but you can continue reading the rest on your own if you're curious about who Geiger was. But we'll read this last paragraph. Many European cultured traditional Jews had no problems with these early innovations. Abraham Geiger was given a rabbinic post in Breslau. He was opposed by the traditional rabbi S.A. Titkin, but after Titkin's death in 1843, Geiger became head of the majority of the Breslau Jewish community. In Breslau, Geiger established a school for religious studies and a group for study of Hebrew philology. He was one of the most active participants in the synods held by the Reform rabbis in Frankfurt and Breslau, and was these synods which resulted in traditional European Jews, led by Rosh Hashanah Flower Hirsch's separating from the Reformers. Okay, you can read a little bit more about him. But anyway, so Abraham Geiger, Rabbi Abraham Geiger, was the founder of Reform Judaism and was essential in making many of these innovations come to be in this time period.
So synod.
Yeah.
That was what their...
I think so, yeah. I think it was their gatherings, something like that. Okay. So this was the difficult world that our Hirsch was born into, and this was the major battle of his life. And in many ways, the person who he became and the writings that he came out with, we'll speak about some of the svarim that he published, were all about counteracting Reform Judaism. That does not mean to say that they weren't part of our tradition, and they weren't part, he wasn't interpreting our traditions and our texts according to, as they should be, according to the Masorah, but he did it with a twist of sort of in the context of this Reform world. He had to make Judaism seem cool and seem hip and seem fresh, but at the same time stay as part of the boundaries of Orthodox Judaism. So that was his major challenge. So, who was Rav Shamshon Flower Hirsch? So again, as we said, he was born in 1808. He was born in Hamburg. Hamburg at that point was actually part of France. He came from a family of Torah. His father was a very learned individual. His grandfather was actually the founder of a Talmud Torah in Hamburg. In 1817, as we said before, there was a Reform temple. We did not say this before. In 1817, when Rav Shamshon Flower Hirsch was 9 years old, the first Reform temple was built in Hamburg. Right? We had one in 1810, but this was the first Reform temple of Hamburg, and it was very similar, again, as we would know it, as a Reform temple nowadays. Take a look at source number 4 for just a moment, just to learn a little bit about more this specific temple. Page number 6. So at the end of 1817, when Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch was 9 years old, the face of Germany, of German Jewry, changed forever. A substantial group of Jews in Hamburg joined together to offer an alternative public expression of Judaism. On December 12, 1817, reformers in Hamburg established the New Israelite Temple Association in Hamburg, and less than a year later, on October 18, 1818, they erected a house of prayer which they named Temple. The Temple was the first Jewish house of worship in Germany to use an organ on the Sabbath and a mixed choir in their services. At the dedication festivities, the assembled were treated to a rendition by a choir of young girls. Right, so for this time period in particular, this was a major innovation and a major slap to the Masorah. The Temple Association also established a new prayer book for Sabbath and holidays in which many prayers were in German and various sections added and deleted at will. The prayer book omitted Birchas HaShachar, Birchas HaTorah, Asher, Psukim, Zimra, right? Many of the things that in theory, by the way, to understand that this was not totally random, if you look at the evolution of tefillah, so these are the things that were in theory added a little bit later, right? The ikar of our tefillah, the main parts of our tefillah are the Shema, Shema, Esrei. Everything else does sort of get added on a little bit later, and we obviously believe it's an obligation to say, these were very thoughtful edits that they were making. They mutilated the Birchos Kriya Shema, did away with the silent Shemona Esrei, Maftir and HaTorah, and changed the Torah readings to a triennial cycle, right? Again, another fascinating thing to know about the triennial cycle is that in the times of the Gemara, there were people who actually did have triennial cycles. So this wasn't a break of absolute halachic Judaism. It was more of a break of how the Masorah has developed. And so even though no Orthodox person in the right mind or no Orthodox shul would ever be caught on a triennial cycle nowadays, it was something that did exist sort of in the sources. So if you were somewhat knowledgeable, you could, right, why didn't they choose a 17-year cycle, right? You could just do three lines every single week. Because there was some semblance of old Judaism, but again, this was not the Orthodox Judaism that had developed over the past thousands of years or so. All mention of the future redemption, this is probably the most important innovation they made, all mention of the future redemption of the Jewish people, the Beis HaMikdash and Mashiach was expunged, presumably in order to prove their sincere patriotism, right? There was always this issue of dual loyalty, right? We hear this even nowadays, of dual loyalty. The Jewish people care about not only the country they're living in, but also they always have to want to care about Israel, right? So there was this concern that if we're going to keep saying we want the return to our land, we want to go back to our land, that means you're not a true patriot, you're not a true nationalist, you don't care about your country, you don't care about Germany enough. So the Reform people did away with this entirely in hopes of fitting in and saying that we don't care about that ancient Jerusalem. We want to live in the new Jerusalem in Germany. The temple was, of course, closed during the week. Within 3 years, membership stood at approximately 100 families, which still constituted less than 10% of Hamburg Jews. So that was the beginning. Obviously, that exploded. Yeah, Zeph.
So I just read a book that was talking about France, and some Hamburg was part of France. What they said was the anti-Semitism that developed, or the free movement to accept fully Jews, wasn't about whether or not you were Jewish. It was if everybody acted according to the way the French acted.
Right.
So whatever your nationality was unacceptable, and there was a certain way of being French. And as long as you accepted that, no matter what your nationality was, you would be accepted as French.
Right.
And it was the cultures that try to maintain their identity, whether it was Jewish then or whether it's Muslim now, that were considered non-French.
Right.
And so a lot of what you're talking about here just feels like that same conversation. Jews trying to be French were accepted in France. Jews trying to be Jews in France were not accepted, not because of anti-Semitism, but because they weren't French.
Yeah. This is the old story of Jews trying to fit in, and this was the newest innovation of how they were trying to fit in. Because of the development of being nationalistic, of having a pride for your country, this was the new attempt among the Reform movement to try and fit in a little bit more in this way. Obviously, again, it didn't work as they would have hoped, and they were still continued to be hated. But nonetheless, that was their attempt. They just wanted to just be like everyone else, right? As the story of our history. This, by the way, this nationalistic perspective is obviously the precursor for Nazis and Nazi Germany and the pure Aryan race. We want to be a proud race. This all comes from this idea of being like purebreds and being proud of the country and proud of the place that you are from and that you live in. We'll read a little bit more from where we are on page 6. So the second to last paragraph on the page, the significance of the actions of the Hamburg group was that for the first time, the reforms were advanced by a unified group from below. The reforms of Israel Jacobson, as we mentioned before, by contrast, were essentially those of a single wealthy individual, albeit with a following. Almost 60 years later, Rabbi Hirsch wrote that with the erection of the temple in Hamburg, the cornerstone was laid for all liturgical reform that was subsequently made in synagogue worship. So in other words, we mentioned earlier that Israel Jacobson, who started the first synagogue in Seesen, Germany, so that wasn't such a big deal because it was just some rich guy just having his way and just building a building. This shul in Hamburg, this temple in Hamburg, this was the first real Reformed temple that had a movement behind it and not just some wealthy philanthropist that wanted to fund it. The reaction of the Hamburg rabbinate to the establishment of the temple and its prayer book was swift and uncompromising. And so as these things sort of go, and we sometimes cringe when we read about the history, right, as the one movement pushes more towards one direction, the other movement pushes in the exact opposite direction. So it's not like we're trying to meet in the middle, it's just more everyone's going further and further apart from one another. On 26th Tishrei, the rabbinate led by the Rosh Basin, Rabbi Baruch Ozer, one of the biggest gedolim that we have in our history in this time period, issued a prohibition against praying in the temple or using its prayer book, right? So nowadays, one of the modern conversations that we have is it permissible or not to go into a reform or a conservative shul? And the reason why this is such an important question is because for so many years, our great rabbis in our traditions all forbade it. They forbade it not because of the explicit prohibition that they found in the text, but rather sort of a societal thing. If I'm going to let my congregants, if I'm going to let my people go into a shul like this, then maybe they will sort of be pulled in. Again, not because they're bad people, but they just won't understand. They'll see the true beauty in what they are selling. They were very good at marketing and advertising their reforms. And so if they, God forbid, would go in, they might be pulled in. And so therefore, some rabbis forbade it. Nowadays, when the tension between Orthodox reform and conservative is not as strong, right? Orthodox clearly, unfortunately and fortunately, has proven how strong it could be and how we are not as concerned of the other movements anymore. So rabbis are a little bit more lenient nowadays going into these other temples because no one's concerned that you're going to become a reform person and you're not going to be impressed anymore. But back in the day, that was a major, major talking point, a major, major, major issue. The top of page 7, the notice was hung in all the shuls and klausen in Hamburg. Rabbi Baruch Ozer also wrote to the leading Torah scholars of Europe and to the Sephardic rabbis of the Ottoman Empire, requesting a halachic response to the following three questions. May the nusach hatzfilah be changed. May the prayers be recited in a foreign language. May the synagogue have an organ, even if it is played on the Sabbath by a non-Jew. Again, all these questions, and in theory, if they wanted to find a loophole or halachic permissibility to these things, in theory they could, but it was all about doubling down on our principles so that people don't mistake Orthodox Judaism for Reform Judaism and then, God forbid, fall off the traditions entirely. So this was all happening in Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch's youth in Hamburg. In 1821, there was an individual by the name of Chacham Isaac Bernays. At least I never really heard of him before I started researching Rav Hirsch's life. He was a very, very important figure. He was appointed to be the chief rabbi of Hamburg when Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch was 13 years old in the year 1821. Again, he's not as much of a household name, but he was important because he became the first major rebbe in Rav Hirsch's life. Interestingly enough, just so you get a little historical context for this guy, Chacham Isaac Bernays, he had a son named Berman Bernays, whose daughter actually married Sigmund Freud. So he was the grandfather-in-law of Freud. So again, just think about it for a second. The grandfather-in-law of Freud was the Rebbe, Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch. So it's just fascinating to think about it like that. In 1824, Rav Hirsch decided that he actually wanted to become a rabbi. He was at the age of 16 that he really realized that this was going to be his calling. So he decided to go and learn with Chacham Bernays. So he learned a lot of Torah from him, and he went to Shiurim in his home for a number of years. By the time he turned 18 in the year 1826, he went to go study in 2 years in a gymnasium. That's like the modern-day high school. We spoke in previous lectures about various characters that at this time, this, even though the thought of going to high school at the age of 18 nowadays sounds like something's wrong with you, that was like a normal thing to do back in the day. It was just a sort of a different world. It seems like I wasn't fully able to get a hold of this. It seems like Rav Hirsch actually received smicha from two individuals. One was Chacham Bernays, and maybe it wasn't a smicha, but it was some sort of a, you know, like a rabbinic head nod, like you're ready to go and become a rabbi. So he learned with him for these couple of years. By the time Rav Hirsch was 20 years old in the year 1828, he went to the city of Mannheim, and he went to go learn by the famous Rosh Hashiva, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger is a very, very important person in Jewish history. He wrote many, many Svarim. The major sefer that many people are familiar with is the Aruch Lener. The Aruch Lener is a major commentary on the Talmud, and a lot of people in the yeshivas like it to this day, and so he was the an important Rebbe in Rav Hirsch's life. So take a look at source number 5 on page 7 really quickly so we can get a little bit more of an appreciation for who Rav Ettlinger was. Source number 5. Rav Yaakov was born in 5568, 1808, in Germany, and spent his youth learning with his father, who was the Rosh Mashifta of the local base Medrash. Afterward, he learned by the Rebbe of the town, who was none other than Rav Asher, the son of the Shagas Aryeh. These are all sort of important figures in our history. Later, he studied under Rav Avram Bing, a Talmud of Rav Nosson Adler, who's Matseva's. Okay, we don't have to read this part. Okay, go to page 8. Okay, the first paragraph there. When he was a mere 18 years old, he was invited to Mannheim, where he became the Rosh Masipta. Among his Talmidim included the future savior of German Jewry, Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch. 10 years later, at the age of 28, he was appointed to the prestigious position of Rav Valtuna, where his predecessors included Rav Yonos and Eibschitz, Rav Yitzchak Charovitz, and Rav Rafael Hamburger. These are, again, major figures in our past. At this point, Rav Yaakov wielded tremendous power as the German authorities recognized his basin, and the government police force was at his disposal to enforce judgments. That's pretty a big deal. Altoona was the only city in Germany not infected by the reform movement. It was the last bastion of Torah in Germany. Okay, you can keep reading a little bit more. But yeah, again, this should just sort of give you a short perspective if you want to read a little bit more over here of just the important Talmudic figure and the important rabbinic figure that he was at this time. And Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch was one of his primary Talmudim. In 1829, when Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch was 21 years old, he went to the University of Bonn. That's where he ended up meeting Abraham Geiger. They had a chavrusa there for a short while. Ultimately, though, Rav Hirsch only stayed there, I believe, for just 6 months. So he never finished a degree there. But again, it sort of goes into the greater mentality of understanding that Rav Hirsch did value secular education, and the fact that he, you know, it's like a, in some ways, it's like a, it's hard to look at it like this, but I think it's important to sort of just to frame it like this. It was like a resume builder, right? Rav Hirsch can then go on later in life and say, I was in university. I studied with some of the greatest scholars of our times in the secular knowledge. So don't tell me that I don't know, you know, secular knowledge and I don't know university. I don't think he went into it as a resume builder, but that certainly was helpful later on to say that he was in university. When he was 22 years old, so again, he was only in university just for a short few months. So when he was 22 years old, just 6 months to, or a year later, in the year 1830, he got his first rabbinic position. He became the chief rabbi of the Grand Duchy of Oldenburg, a very small Jewish community, but he stayed there actually for 11 years. In 1831, just another year later, he marries his wife, who's Hannah Judel. They have 10 children together. We'll note just a few of the children that they have together. Obviously, one of them is very important because, we'll see why it's important in just a little bit. In 1833, they have their first son, Mendel Hirsch. In 1834, they have their first daughter, Sarah Hirsch. In 1836, when Rav Hirsch is 28 years old, he publishes his first major book. That is the book called 19 Letters. That's this book right over here. It's fake letters that he made up between two people who were friends as children, and they grew up. They went in slightly separate ways. There was there was a person named Binyamin who was a young and passionate Jew trying to understand the world and the being more pulled in the reform ways, and there was Naftali, who is his, again, childhood friend, who became a rabbi. So it's letters, fake letters between the two of them, where he's trying to bring him back into the fold and help him show that an Orthodox lifestyle really is the right lifestyle, and how the Orthodox mindset truly is the correct mindset. To give more of a framework to understand, again, how Rav Hirsch wrote all of his books, and he has a commentary on the Torah that we'll speak about in a little while. Everything he wrote was, again, trying to make people realize that Orthodox Judaism, and again, Orthodoxy wasn't Orthodoxy, it was Judaism, but that Judaism and the Masorah Dika Judaism is founded in an absolute eternal truths. It was a beautiful perspective on life. It wasn't some like this again. He wasn't the Jew in the rags living in a ghetto. That's not what Judaism is all about. That's not the major tenets of Judaism. Judaism is about these major foundational beliefs that are eternally true. So even if you bring science, even if you bring all these new studies that we have in the world, at the end of the day, Judaism will prove to be just as strong and just as intellectually rigorous as all these other things, and still ultimately prove to be true above anything else. And that was his major, major push with all of his writings. So 19 Letters was just this. It's important to understand as the context of 19 Letters that this was not the first book that he wanted to publish. The first book that he wanted to publish is called Chorit. That's this book right over here. It's the English translation of it. So let's take a look at source number 6 to first get more of a context of what 19 Letters was, and then we'll discuss how it came to be published before Chori was published. So take a look at source number 6 on the bottom of page 8. Bearing witness to the strange phenomenon are the 19 Letters on Judaism, which Hirsch wrote in 1838 at the age of 28, and which remains his most renowned book. The reason why, by the way, it's probably his most famous book is because it's his shortest book. Right? Well, you'll see in a moment that 19 Letters is sort of like the precursor and synopsis in some ways of what Chori was all about. An additional note about German authors in general, and Hirsch was no different in this situation, is that German authors, especially the most distinguished and most intellectual, would write a lot. Like, a lot. Like, if you read through the introduction, from what I understand, I've never read through all of Chori, but I read through most of the introduction, and my understanding is that the introduction of Chori that other people have written, in more modern times, is actually almost like a full synopsis of the book in like 30 pages, what he does in about 600 pages. So it was just the way of German writing back in the day, that you just write a lot, and you make the point again and again and again. But so that was sort of his style as well. So again, let's go back to source number 6. Okay, bearing witness to the strange phenomenon of the 19 Letters on Judaism, which Hirsch wrote in 1838 at the age of 28, and which remains his most renowned book, they are addressed to Benjamin, an imaginary, typical young intellectual of the day to whom Judaism had lost relevancy. Toward Benjamin's return and that of the Legion of Benjamins, right, people like him, Hirsch composed a fiery apologia for orthodoxy, calling for use of the general sciences as auxiliary studies for understanding the Torah, right? Don't tell me that the study of sciences enhances it. Don't tell me that the study of sciences is greater than Torah. Rather, it enhances your perspective of what the Torah is actually really getting at. You want to truly understand what Sefer Bereishis is all about? Well, we have to know physics. We have to know these things so we can understand the greatness. It's not that they're two separate entities. All modern intellectual pursuits will enrich your understanding of the Torah itself, because the Torah is ultimately the foundation of it all. That was his big calling card. Rereading the letters in this new edition and more polished translation, one is struck by the way in which this valiant defender of the faith, without being quite aware of it, speaks the words of his opponents, even at times going farther in their own direction. Judaism, in Hirsch's definition, emerges as largely a dogmatic religion with major emphasis on tenets of belief and sets of observances. The national factor is only vaguely dealt with, limited in effect to the designation of Israel as a religious nation. Israel occupied a territory and constituted a state, but these, in Hirsch's view, were means only for the people's spiritual calling. We'll speak a little bit about how Hirsch sort of developed as a Zionist, or we should really call him probably an anti-Zionist. He was I'm not going to call him the anti-Rav Kook, but I guess I did just call him the anti-Rav Kook, right? He really became a proud German Jew, and to such an extent that he was not a big fan of moving to Israel and these kinds of movements that, again, were starting to really take root also at this time, a few years later, but really around this time. So Hirsch advocated that the religious Jewish mission as strongly as any of his universalistic reform confreres. He conceived that mission to be largely an individual task and hailed the emancipation as a new ground for it. Okay, let's skip off. I'll go to the next paragraph. But Hirsch's use of contemporary German philosophical methodology may be regarded as more significant even than his unconscious espousal of reform emphases. He puts great stress on understanding Judaism from within and finds fault with Maimonides and Mendelssohn for incorporating foreign elements into the ancient faith. No outside criteria, no devoutly constructed hypotheses may be applied to Judaism, right? Judaism speaks for itself. The Torah speaks for itself. I don't need any outside things to really do that for me, right? In our Shabbos afternoon chair yesterday, we noted that the Gra calls the Rambam out for being affected by Aristotle and modern and his day's philosophy. Rav Hirsch was a purist. The Torah speaks for itself. The Torah has everything you'll ever need. And anything else could enrich it in theory, but again, all that ultimately can be sourced back to the Torah. Judaism must be organically comprehended, yet this precisely is what Hirsch did not do. The distinction between investigating Judaism from without and from within points to Hegel's plea to consider phenomena not alone as they appear to us, but as we feel them in their inner meaning. When Hirsch proposes to extract this inner basic Jewish spirit from Bible and Talmud, he follows Herder, to whom the literature of a people reveals its most fundamental characteristics. The Hirsch approach resembles most, perhaps that of the, however you pronounce that, a group of young intellectuals in the Berlin of 1819 who were banded together to rehabilitate Judaism, to trace systematically the individual parts, the basic principle of the whole, okay, yada, 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 feel free to keep reading on your own. But again, so that's everything. That's how he decided to write 19 letters, to give this real pure approach to Judaism, to show how strong Judaism and how amazing it is that it speaks for itself. But in doing so, he also did use the sort of outside, he used the reform arguments against themselves when he wrote this book, to show how amazing and pure our Jewish traditions actually are. Okay. Now, so take a look at source number 7. We'll read through maybe one or two paragraphs. This is the first letter in which the intellectual one, right, the one who was sort of going off the path, he was writing to his youth friends. So he's writing to Naftali. Naftali was the rabbi. So he says, "My dear Naftali," page 10, "when recently we met again after many years of separation, you did not imagine what interest the subject of our current conversation had for me," right? They were old friends, and what do you know? Naftali was dressed like a rabbi, and Benjamin was, like, you know, maybe clearly a very secular Jew. And so they had a conversation, and like old friends, they were smoozing. I remember when we were in the Talmud Torah, and we learned whatever, and now look at where we are now. So he says as follows, "You found me so changed in my religious views and practices that despite your usual tolerance..." "You cannot help asking, since when and why? I answered you with a whole series of accusations against Judaism based upon my reading and contact with the world since I had left home and my parents. You listened quietly, and then you said, 'Do you really think you understand the subject which you are attacking?'" Right? So in other words, the argument is, do you really actually... you heard a few interesting and cool things of the modern day sciences, and therefore you threw out the whole Torah. But do you actually even understand the Torah in the first place to be able to throw it out just like you did so quickly? Have you tried by honest and earnest investigation to acquire a real understanding of the most sacred and important aspect of our lives? You point to the only sources of my own knowledge, the mechanical practice of parental customs, a few fragments of the Bible and Talmud taught me in an old-fashioned cheder, the writings of certain Christian authors and reformers, and in general a view of life based upon a suppression of the inner voice of conscience in favor of the demands of superficial pleasure and comfort. I was forced to admit the gaps in my knowledge. I asked you for instruction, and the coachman called, and you had only time to call out to me, 'I will write.' My dear Naftali, while you have thus made me distrustful of my own views, you have neither refuted them nor given me better ones in their stead." So really, it's just an honest and open conversation that this poor Benjamin is having with his old friend, who is now a rabbi, Naftali, trying to reclaim his old ancient past and trying to understand why he actually really threw it out in the first place. And so it really it speaks to many people who were having that inner conflict in those days, trying to understand what life they were going to live. Were they going to be the intellectual reformed Jew, or were they going to be the Orthodox Jew who follows the ancient Masorah? So again, feel free to keep reading. I do have the book here. I took it out from the YU library, but if you want to read it, let me know. But it's not a very expensive book if you want to buy it on Amazon as well. Okay, so let's keep going. In 1837, so that was in 1836. 1837, the next year, Rav Hirsch decides to publish Chorib. So how did this all come to be? Why was it that Chorib was published after 19 Letters, even though Chorib was really written before 19 Letters? So take a look at source number 8 on page 12. When in April 1835, Hirsch sent the manuscript of the Chorib to his friend and cousin in Hamburg, the 19 letters on Judaism had not yet been written. In accordance with Hirsch's request, his friend Z.H. May looked round for a publisher for the Chorev. After having seen the extensive manuscript, a well-known non-Jewish publisher in the neighboring town of Altona suggested that the author of the Chorev should first try to incorporate his ideas in a smaller book or brochure, which would entail less financial risk, right? So you have a choice. You can publish a 100-page book, or you can publish a 600-page book. Which is going to be cheaper? 100-page book. So just try that. If people like it, then you can publish the big one also. Should that small book prove a success, the publisher would then be prepared to proceed with the publication of the Chorin. Hirsch accepted this suggestion, and so it came about that he wrote under the pseudonym of Ben Uziel. Right, we forgot to mention, but very famously, when he wrote the 19 letters, it was not written by Rav Shamshon Elkar Hirsch. It was written by Ben Uziel. Why? Because no one knew who Rav Hirsch was. So he figured, might as well just use a pen name. There shouldn't be any associations with his name. And if it goes well, great. If not, not. People, we'll keep reading and see what actually happened. The book bore the subtitle, A Question to the Public Concerning the Publication of the same author's essays on Israel and its duties. On the title page, there also appeared the significant quotation from the Talmud. It is manifest. Okay, you can read it. Galoy v'adol panech shaludach v'odias. He's right. He wrote that this is not for himself that he's writing this. He's writing this for the sake of the Jewish people to clarify things for the Jewish people. It is manifest before thee, O Lord, what I have written was not done for the sake of my own honor, nor for the sake of the honor of my father's house, but for thine honor alone, in order that strife and dissensions may not spread in Israel. Both this inscription and the fact that the 19 letters was published under a pseudonym are characteristic of Hirsch's intensity and singleness of purpose. Right? He realized he was really just a man on a mission. He saw himself very early on as being the number one opponent of the Reform movement, and he owned it. He really became that. He realized that he was the one that was going to help fight against Reform Judaism. The answer of the public in replying to Hirsch's question to it concerning the publication of the Chorib was given in no uncertain terms. The 19 letters made an enormous impression upon the Jews. Page 13. Okay, it seems to be like a non sequitur over here. Oh, no, yeah. The 19 letters made an enormous impression upon the Jews in Germany, of all shades of opinion. It became one of the decisive books of that era, and it was no exaggeration when Professor Bernard Drachman of New York, the first translator of the 19 letters into English, wrote in 1899 that this work marked an epoch in the history of Judaism in Germany and indeed in the world. In the preface to the 19 letters, Hirsch says, should the Chorev appear, then these 19 letters will take the place of the introductory outlines. That gives you a sense of how long Chorev was going to be, if this was going to be the introduction for it. It will take the place of the introductory outlines to which the 19th letter refers and which are considered an essential part of the Chorev. The two books, Chorev and the 19 letters, belong therefore together. They contain the fundamentals of Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's philosophy of Judaism and of Jewish law. An introductory essay to Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's Chorev must therefore also deal, however, briefly with the 19 letters on Judaism, which are fundamental to the understanding of Chorev. Okay. Good. So he published Chorev in 1837, just a year later. Once Chorev came out, the Reform movement realized that they were being bashed, and I realized also I never fully explained what Chorev was. Chorev goes through many of the commandments that we have. And again, Reform Judaism was all about saying, bless you, Reform Judaism was all about saying that we don't need to keep all the commands. We can sort of become more modern, normal people. We don't have to do these old ancient traditions. Hirsch went through most, if not all, of the mitzvos and tried to explain why these are relevant to this very day. You look a little funny walking around with a lulav and esrog. Well, let me tell you what the real significance, how this is important even for an intellectual elite. It's still an important thing to do. That was his main mission when he wrote Chorev, again, to give the philosophy of Judaism and show how it's still so important and crucial to this very day. Okay. In the year 1838, he had two more children. Julie and Marcus Hirsch were born. I don't believe they were twins. I think they were born separately because he has twins later on. In the year 1841, Rav Hirsch was installed as the chief rabbi in Emden. That was his first major move from this old place. To get a real sense of the person that Rav Hirsch was, he wasn't actually a right-wing person, he wasn't a left-wing person, he was actually a relatively centrist person. That's why in so many ways he's considered the father of modern Orthodox Judaism, because not only did the Reform people hate him, but the right-wing Jews hated him as well. So that's how you know you're doing something right when everyone hates you. So every side was fighting. Before he became the rabbi in Emden, every side was fighting that he shouldn't be hired. He got the job anyways, but that's how it was. He was the rabbi in Emden for 6 years. He was so busy when he was in Emden that he didn't write anything. Someone who actually loved and enjoyed clearly writing, he was not able to write any svarim at this time because he was so busy working with the people. He wrote, when he was in Emden, this is not in your source sheet, but he wrote, I am overwhelmed with work from morning until evening, and more often than not, I do not put my pen down until after midnight. I am a beast of burden, bearing the load of the quarrels and affairs of the holy flock whose shepherd I am. That's how intense his time was there. He was literally always busy helping the people of that community. In 1842, he has another child. Julius Hirsch is born in 1843 when he was 35 years old. Just gives you a sense of how accomplished this guy was by the time he was 35. He wrote wrote two books, and he was always already the rabbi in another major community. So he started a school when he was 35 years old in Emden. In 1844, he had another child, Naftali Hirsch, that was born in 1847. He becomes the rabbi of a place called Nicholsburg. Now, this was a very significant job opportunity for Rav Hirsch, as he essentially was the rabbi of over 50,000 Jews. Right? When we say he became the rabbi of a certain area, he wasn't a shul, it was that he became the rabbi of a certain city. So there were 50,000 Jews that he was responsible for in this position, which he did not last very long, and he tried to make some adjustments and some helpings for the community, but ultimately it seemed like it was not the right place for him. He therefore decided to leave after a very short time in Nicholsburg. After it was clear that he was going to leave, the community tried to fight for him, but it turns out that he actually already accepted a position elsewhere, which we'll see in a second, and therefore he ended up taking the position elsewhere. In 1849, he had a child, Therese Hirsch, that was born. Notice the names also. These names are not Hebrew names. They're names of the people of the times. Again, because he was a German Jew. He was a proud Jew, but also he was German. He wanted to make sure that people were fully aware of that. I believe if you look in the Art Scroll of biography, which is a lot of what we used to sort of put out this lecture this morning, they have their Hebrew names in there, but I do not believe he called them by their Hebrew names. I believe he called them by their German names, because he was a proud German. He wanted to make sure that people were proud of the culture, and again, to show that we are loyal to the country we're living in, but we're also, again, consistent and connected and loyal to our own traditions as well. In 1851, when Rav Hirsch was 42, 43 years old, he became the rabbi of a shul that would be the shul of the rest of his life. It was a very, very small and dying shul at that point. It was in Frankfurt. It had about 100 members in the shul, which at that point was very small. It's noteworthy, by the way, that there actually was a choir in this shul, and again, it does end up feeding more into the ultimate perspective and philosophy that Rav Hirsch will develop, and that you could have some of these things. You can't have an organ, but you could have a choir, right? Where can we make the compromises to make people feel like we're part of this newer elite group, but also at the same time still staying consistent with our own traditions? At this point, when he became the rabbi of this new shul, it was a very complicated feeling in the community in Frankfurt, and that is because something that we as American Jews are not very familiar with in Europe. The way it works is that all the taxes were collected based on the community that you were a part of, whichever religious denomination you were a part of. So all your taxes were sort of funneled in together. So what that means is that if you have a Reform Jewish community and an Orthodox Jewish community, well, the government at the time didn't see that as two separate religions. They said you were the Jews. So all the Jews' taxes went to the same thing. The problem is, if all the Jews' taxes went to the same things, are they going to pay the Reform rabbi salaries? Are they going to support the Reform temple? Or are they going to support the Orthodox temple? So this was a very big issue. And so in Frankfurt, what they did was they decided to try to secede from this to a small extent. They were not able to fully secede, but what they did was they created something, the Israelite Religion Schlaft, which was the Jewish Religious Society, otherwise known as the ERG. Right? This was a very important organization that sort of framed the Frankfurt community for Rav Shamsher and Rav Lahr Hirsch, and ended up being the paradigm for other European communities as well, as I believe. In his first address to the community in Frankfurt, Rav Hirsch said something that I pulled out because I thought it's very relevant for our American community here. He says, "Success was not measured by numbers of people, but rather by the intensity with which they dedicated themselves to their holy purpose. Not by might and not by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of the hosts." I really like that line. I just wanted to share. Okay, so it was at this point when he was in his shul that he created the famous slogan that would take him, that still is he's most well known for today, and that is the slogan of Torah im Derech Eretz. We don't, and this is a very controversial line which we'll explain in just a moment, but Torah im Derech Eretz was all about saying that we don't just have Torah. Obviously Torah is our foundation, that's why it comes first in the slogan, but we also have Derech Eretz. What's Derech Eretz? Anyone know what's Derech Eretz? So not how he meant it. Be a normal person. Well, we're part of the world. We know other things. We're collecting the culture around us to be a part of our culture as well. So that's when Torah in Derech Eretz started, when he was in this shul. Okay, turn to page 16. What in the world is Torah in Derech Eretz? So there's a fascinating essay. Just out of curiosity, I just want to get a sense from the crowd. People want to end soon, or people want to? How are people doing in terms of time? Cool. Okay.
What time's
mental? Okay. Okay. I just wanted to get a sense. Okay. People are good. Everyone's content. No. 3 hours.
I understand if I have-
whenever. Anyone can leave whenever. I like to make this about an hour long, so now we're at 51 minutes. So hopefully in the next 15 minutes will be my goal to finish up. Okay, so in source number 9, there's a fascinating essay that I found, and that is from Torah Im Derech Eretz to Torah Umada. People like to say that Yeshiva University's slogan is Torah Umada. Very famously, Rabbi Soloveitchik, as we spoke about, I think in Rabbi Soloveitchik's year, Rabbi Soloveitchik never once said Torah Umada, but nonetheless, that sort of became the calling card of Yeshiva University. It also became the calling card of modern Orthodoxy. We are Torah observant, but we're also normal, quote-unquote. We also follow the sciences, and right, part of the world, right? So it's a little complicated, because Torah and Derech Eretz was not fully what Torah Umada is, but nonetheless, Torah and Derech Eretz clearly was the precursor for what Torah Umada would become. So let's take a look at source number 9 very quickly on page number 16. Not only was Hirsch interested in German intellectual trends, but also he was a fiercely proud German and embraced many aspects of broader European culture. Most importantly, he believed that European culture had substantive, not merely instrumental value. In other words, Hirsch did not view the diffusion of secular culture into Jewish life as detrimental to German Jewry, since much of European culture, he believed, was intrinsically good and not just useful. In an essay in 1854, Hirsch wrote, "Orthodox Judaism has no reason to fear the light of the world or fear that its own light be eclipsed by the bright sunshine of any genuine culture." Hirsch saw no reason to completely shy away from secular culture, despite the natural limits of cultural integration that he defended. Moreover, a close reading of the rest of his 1854 essay reveals a profound implication by describing Jewish culture as a light. Hirsch evokes common Jewish symbolism of the light of Torah, or the light that the Jewish people are unto the world, yet Hirsch describes German or Western European culture as a bright sunshine as well, right? Thereby implying that it too serves to better mankind, perhaps with greater vigor, even than the light of 19th century German Jewry. That Hirsch judges Europe to offer a genuine culture additionally suggests either European culture is substantively on par with Jewish culture, or that it is qualitatively distinct from Judaism. Right? Either or is going to be a very complicated thing for a rabbi of that time to take. People didn't know what to do with him. Is he Orthodox? Is he Reform? What is he? Obviously he was Orthodox, but this was a very modern approach to say that I can accept other things going on in the world and not just stay in my little shtetl, in my little ghetto over here. Read a little bit more. If the latter, it appears that Hirsch believes European culture offers benefits unavailable with hermetically constructed Judaism. According to Rosenblum, Hirsch had a deep emotional feeling for German and a strong attachment to German culture. That Hirsch wrote and lectured largely in German when rabbis had written commentaries and biblical exegesis in Hebrew for centuries was not only a product of pragmatism but also of an ideological commitment to German culture. Hirsch didn't see, what's the point of writing in Hebrew, he said. I want everyone to understand what I'm writing. So I'm going to write in German so everyone can actually get it. Oh, that sounds like a very Reform thing to do. Okay, maybe it's what the Reform people are doing, but it's also practical. I want people to understand the Torah that I'm giving over. So again, you keep reading over here if anyone's interested in the full essay. Please let me know. But again, so Torah and Derech Eretz was all about interacting with the rest of the world. In 1852, Sophie and Jenny Hirsch were born. They were twins, and I believe they were also the last children that Rav Hirsch had. They were numbers 9 and 10. Why are they important? Well, Jenny Hirsch is particularly important. Jenny Hirsch married a man by the name of Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Zalman Breuer. Okay, so who was he? Well, he took over for Rav Hirsch once he passed away. He became the rabbi in Frankfurt. Their son, Rabbi Dr. Joseph Breuer, ended up taking over yeshiva in Frankfurt after his father, but then he founded the Breuer Shul in Washington Heights. So that's how the Germans got to Washington Heights. It was Rav Hirsch's grandson. That's why we were naming all the children. Okay, in 1853... Grandson. Yeah, exactly, yeah. The famous Breuer Synagogue in Washington Heights was named, I don't think it was named Breuer's before he got there, right? It was named Breuer's because he was the rabbi of the shul, his grandson was the rabbi. Okay, in 1853, Rav Hirsch founded what he called the real shul. What was the real shul? That's a German word, it means school, right? So it was a school in Frankfurt, and Rav Hirsch actually ended up establishing 3 other schools in his time when he was there. Rav Hirsch was a big egalitarian. What do we mean by the fact that he was a big egalitarian? Well, certainly not how we define it nowadays, but he was a big proponent of women's education, light years ahead. All right, everyone talks about Sarah Schneer. She was obviously a very big, important figure in the 1900s. In the 1800s, Rav Hirsch was a champion of saying that women have to learn also. We can't just let our women be uneducated. So he allowed the boys and the girls to learn the exact same things in school other than Gemara and math. Those things the girls were not allowed to learn. Okay, he wasn't that ahead of his time. But he was still very ahead of his time in that they were learning a lot of other things. But again, Gemara and math still was not something that girls were allowed to learn back then. But for his time, understand, they learned everything else. That was a very big deal. Okay, in 1862, a very important year and a very important moment in Rav Hirsch's life, he was 54 years old. He was pushed to advance the early Israeli Zionistic movement. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who we actually spoke about in the Rav Kook Breakfast in the Base, he wrote a book called Rishat Zion, about how we're yearning and desiring to move back to the land of Israel. This was in the 1800s. And he said, please, Rav Hirsch, can you please say that you like my book, and then you write a haskama, whatever. And Rav Hirsch was not a very big fan of this at all. Read you a quote. Although Rabbi Hirsch agreed that it was important to support those Jews who currently lived in Eretz Yisrael, he expressed concern that mass settlement activity would bring in its wake increased risk of Sabbath desecration and the transgressions of agricultural mitzvahs unique to Eretz Yisrael. So this was a precursor to some of the more right-wing anti-Zionist perspectives, and that is that ultimately, as much as we want to go back to the land of Israel, nonetheless, we have to really wait for the times of Mashiach, because if we do it before Mashiach, then we risk people being machalel, or being desecrating lots of commandments. In particular, people will desecrate Shabbos, people will desecrate trumos and maestros, right? Tithing of the fruits and everything. How are they going to know how to do that? We haven't done that for so many years. So therefore, he was very anti this, and that became fit very well into the mentality that Rav Hirsch was sort of developing, and that is, we're proud German Jews. If we are proud German Jews, that means as Orthodox Jews, we still have to be yearning for the Geula, we have to be yearning for the redemption, to return back to Yerushalayim, back to Jerusalem, but nonetheless, we're very happy where we are right now. We like Germany. Germany is a very nice place, and they're very nice to us, and so we want to sort of keep this. And so he was not pro pushing the Zionistic movement as much as other people. In 1865, they were up to 200 members in the shul. They had grown quite a bit. They doubled their size. In 1867 to 1878, that was a span of 11 years, Rav Hirsch wrote his very famous commentary on the Chumash. Right? So the reason why this is a very important thing that he did when he wrote the commentary on the Chumash was because in the late 1800s was the development of what we know as the documentary hypothesis, saying that God was not the author of the Torah. Right? Rav Hirsch, that actually came out, I believe, after Rav Hirsch wrote his commentary, but nonetheless, it was sort of still the cultural context that he was living in, right, by Wheelhausen. He said that the Torah was not written by God. It was written by J-E-P-N-D. Right? Those are the different authors of the Torah. And we obviously don't believe in that. And the documentary hypothesis, by the way, is disproven many times at this point. There are still people who believe in it. All right, we can talk about that another time. It's a very fascinating topic. But Rav Hirsch, in the context of this historical world that he was living in, says, I have to write a commentary on the Torah to show you that even though some things in the Torah maybe seem a little weird, seem a little bit off, maybe even grammatically, right? This was a time of intellectual elitism. So if I can relearn biblical Hebrew, I can tell you the Torah isn't written the right way, right? Why would the Torah have a vav over there, right? Rashi says the point of the vav is to, you can extrapolate a lot of laws out of it. The intellectual German will say, oh, this is stupid. They put a vav in the wrong place. So Rav Hirsch had to write a commentary to make sense of all of this. And he wrote a beautiful commentary. We own it in our house. It's highly recommended. He has fantastic, amazing chidushim in so many areas in the Chumash. And again, this is all to sort of bring people back in realizing that the elite does not live outside of the Torah, rather inside the Torah. There's so much greatness and purity and depth in the Torah that people hadn't even begun to unpack, and that was the purpose of his commentary. It's really, really, again, highly recommended. By the 1870s, there was a major battle in Frankfurt, and ultimately his community was able to secede from the Reform community, so they developed two separate communities. There was the Reform and the Orthodox, such that the Orthodox taxes were no longer going to the Reform. They actually were totally going and being funneled towards the Orthodox world. In 1874, so how many years was that when he came to the shul? He came to the shul in 1851. So 23 years later, there were 1,800 people in the shul. So that way he multiplied it by 18 times. All right, so God willing, Eric also. In 1876... Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch was 68 years old.
When are you going to write your commentary?
Well, we'll see. So in 1876, when he was 68 years old, this law was officially passed to allow the Jews to secede, the Orthodox Jews to secede. This obviously created a whole tumult. Take a look at source number 10 about what happened. Feel free to take a look at source number 10 on your own time, but this talks a little bit about what happened in this historical context, how the Reform Jews responded to the split, and obviously it was not such a popular thing to do. In 1885, Rav Hirsch created a national organization, which he called, I don't know, No, that was created earlier on. It was called the Orthodox Union, not the OU that we know nowadays. Not the OU, not the OU. Not the, okay, calm down. It was a big deal, but not the OU. Okay, so, but it was a precursor for what we call the Agudat of Israel movement, right? The Agudat movement. And so this organization, it was important because it, for the first time, gathered and united all the Orthodox Jews and all the little communities throughout Europe. There were these small, and in Germany, there were these small Orthodox Jews, little pockets, and they felt like they were all alone. This helped to unite everyone and bring everyone together in a more united fashion, which is obviously, even though it was not the actual Orthodox Union as we know it, it obviously in many ways is a precursor for the concept of the OU as we have it nowadays in America. The point of this group was to help those individuals who did not want to work on Shabbos. It helped set up kosher food establishments. It trained shochtim, right? So it was kind of like the OU that we know it. So again, the precursor for all of this. In 1888, on the 27th of Tevet, 5649, Rav Hirsch passed away, and he was buried in the Erg Cemetery there in Germany. In summary, if you want to understand who Rav Hirsch was, he was a fierce fighter for Orthodox Judaism, vehemently against the reform movement, but not just in words. He didn't just say that it was stupid and try to make people ignore it. He presented Judaism in a light, in a way that, again, in our days it seems like this is what everyone does, but he was the first. He said that Judaism is the elite. Don't think that the others who say they're learning their arts and their music and literature, that they're so amazing. We can learn all that and be greater because we have the Torah at the foundation. The Torah is the MS. He was and is to this day really known as the founder and the father of modern Orthodox Judaism, such that the Judaism that we live in nowadays, the Young Israel movement, all that we have here in America really could be traced back to the innovations and the greatness of which and the strength that Rav Hirsch led Orthodox Judaism. So I thank you all for listening and everyone have a great day.